You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
This is 192?
192.
Dang, man. It's like we keep doing these things.
I know. The number never goes down.
I guess we could.
We hit a number and then start counting down?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, episode 191, bravo. 190, bravo. Do something stupid like that. So, put a tango on the end and have both in flight at the same time.
I was about to say, like, you know, when United has to run two flights at the same flight number.
Yeah, because one was inexplicably delayed, or probably quite explicably delayed, but they still ran the second connection, the second half of the direct itinerary on time.
And given my experience this week, it most likely would be to Berlin.
So what happened with that? I mean, I know they eventually canceled one of them, but how was your
so
what happened?
So
how'd you get home?
How'd I get home? So let me think about this. I got to Berlin Friday, so I was supposed to fly home Berlin Newark on Saturday, and Thursday night's Berlin Newark was delayed like 6.5 hours. So okay. Friday morning's Berlin Newark was 6.5 hours late, and it was plane coming from San Juan, came from San Juan to Newark on time. Went mechanical at Newark, and then took a rolling delay. So okay. I'm like, well, hopefully, you know, Friday night I'm going to bed. It's still showing on time. The flight's getting ready to leave. And I'm like, well, hopefully, you know, it'll take off in time. And I just happened to wake up at 5 a.m. And I'm like, I should go back to bed. I've got some time. I'm like, oh, let me just check my flight status. And sure enough, I pop it up. It's delayed 7 hours.
That's not good.
I'm like, God, crap. So I jump out. I call United. And this time I got a really good agent who, you know, said, I see some availability through Brussels. She found it immediately. She confirmed my upgrade. She gave me a seat with an empty seat next to it. So I had two seats coming home.
Nice.
The drawback was I left 3 hours earlier. Not okay. Ideal, but so I had to forego my breakfast and literally just take a quick shower and run to the airport.
Yeah, so you basically were like on like an 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock out of...
No, 6:55.
Oh, super early.
Yeah, because the Brussels flight leaves at 10 a.m., so...
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so really early. And, you know, it made me appreciate Tegel for what it is. I mean, it's a nice, easy airport to get in and out of. I walked into the terminal at 6:15. I walked in, you know, there's no delay, there's nothing. I rolled right in. Perfect. Turns out, someone we know was actually on the inbound on Friday night. And so it turns out that the inbound from San...
Was it his fault?
We could start blaming him at this point. I'm thinking I'm not taking any flights with him on it. The inbound from San Juan got in on time. Then it had a TCAS problem. So they tried to fix the TCAS problem for a few hours. Then they finally gave up and moved to a different plane to take over. And when they brought the other plane... from the hangar at like 10:30 at night, which by the way had been sitting on the ground for 5 days because it came in with a mechanical from London 5 days sooner.
Oh.
They noticed electrical problems in the galley. And so they took an extended delay, and basically they pushed back, like they forgot to cater the flight somehow. I don't know how.
I guess when they moved over to the new metal, they didn't move the food over?
Right. In theory, they said they did, but they clearly did not. So I guess someone from the terminal went running to OTG and bought like 300 sandwiches and trash bags and brought them back to the plane.
That's amazing.
It is. It is. And they pushed back with like 10 minutes before the crew timed out. And by the time they got to the runway, the crew timed out.
Oh.
So they came back, got dumped in the terminal. United posts a slight delay on it, an hour delay. And then they eventually canceled the flight, and they ran a special section Saturday night, which was an hour and a half delayed.
With all these people on it.
And then the return from Tegel is – the plane's still sitting in Tegel. It never took off. So I don't know what happened to the return. It's extra edition.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
So just one quick acronym play, TCAS, Traffic Collision Avoidance System. That's the one that tells if you're about to hit another airplane, right?
Yes.
Okay, so kind of important to have.
Especially over the North Atlantic where there's no radar.
Yes. Yes. And you're supposed to just, you know who else is out there and pay attention on your own.
Exactly.
As opposed to, you know, being particularly well guided. It's actually interesting. Aero Savvy, his name is Ken Hoke, I believe is how it's pronounced, is a UPS pilot that's pretty active on Twitter, a fun guy, who I keep meaning to ask if he wants to be on the show, but he posted something the other day that when you're flying across the Atlantic, often, even when you're on a particular track, you'll fly either directly on that track or 1 or 2 miles off of it.
Okay.
Just in case.
Okay.
And it's, you know, your, you know, lateral separation just in case kind of thing. And it's sort of randomized based on who's flying and if that airline does it and if the pilot or the co-pilot is in charge and all these other things, but just sort of an extra little step of something because out of, like you said, out of the North Atlantic, there's less control of traffic. I thought that was interesting. And in China, that you can't do it in China, but they tell people to fly, like the Chinese ATC will tell people to fly offset from the main track. So weird stuff in the air. Interesting stuff. Well, anyways, glad you're back.
Thank you.
In one form or another, I guess, you know, the downside is no EU compensation. The good news is you actually got home. So.
Yeah, I mean, had I waited out, I would have got an extra night in Berlin on United's dime.
Yeah, and 600 euro.
And 600 euro.
Maybe worth it, maybe not. Depends on what you had to do. And obviously we had to record this. So, I mean, you may not have been home in time for this, and then what would we have done?
That's true. That is true. It would have just been you, let alone on your own.
Yeah, that would be awkward, me monologuing for extended periods of time. Unlike, you know, an episode where it's just me talking at you guys for extended periods.
Details.
Let's talk Chicago.
Yes.
So American Airlines last week announced a whole bunch of route changes, and a lot of it was in Chicago. There's some from Miami and Dallas as well. But one of the big deals is they're canceling the O'Hare-Beijing flight.
Yes.
After like a decade of general failure to make profits of any, or forget profits. This was, it was real interesting. The VP of network did a podcast because American actually does a internal corporate podcast that you can listen to publicly. And one of the things he said is that something to the effect of a lot of the time we didn't even pay for the fuel on board for that flight, which is, even when it's operating on a 787, apparently that's the case. So, you know, the most fuel efficient plane they could find, they still couldn't get it to work right.
Which, I mean, is surprising. And then they cited things like Delhi was another one like that, which they ran for years, but that was on the
Helsinki was one, Delhi, Moscow.
Helsinki surprises me, particularly since it's part of the JV and you could put onward connections on it.
You'd think, yeah. I mean, and right, and be it, excuse me, American does a ton of traffic over Heathrow, specifically for those onward connections.
So here's what's interesting to me, right? So he basically made the comment of they struggle in Chicago to have profitable flights. Yet they're adding to Beijing, something they compete with United. Helsinki was something unique to them. Clearly Heathrow is something they compete with United, BA, and Virgin. But two of the big additions, the one big addition is Chicago Honolulu, which United,
right, and that's,
United already flies.
But that, and they're only going to do it, at least for now, for the winter season. They haven't committed to making that year round.
Okay. But still, they're competing. And then they're adding, like, Newark Aruba, which is something, not Newark, Chicago Aruba, which United flies already. Chicago Grand Cayman, which I believe United flies already. Chicago Nassau, which United flies already. I think, PLS
and
is the only
Turks and Caicos.
Yeah, that's the only one that United does not fly right
now. Yeah, what's interesting to me about all of those is, again, they're adding them as seasonal Saturday only.
Right.
So they're going for basically timeshare traffic or, you know, week-long vacation traffic. These are people, you fly in on your Saturday, you land, you do your thing, you come home the next Saturday. This is high leisure traffic. But in the winter season, leisure traffic can be, especially from, you know, upper Midwest to the Caribbean, can be very profitable. It's the other, and this is one of the things that I should probably find the guy's name. The guy in the podcast said is
Basu.
Yeah, Basu. One of the things he said was basically they're shifting from just run every flight the same time and same plane 7 days a week to a much more nuanced schedule. So you do increased traffic to business destinations Monday through Friday, maybe a little less on Tuesday and Wednesday because those aren't as big business days. And on the weekends, you pull back. And so these Saturday-only services are planes that would otherwise be sitting idle. And, you know, JetBlue did this to the Caribbean with its Mint service when they had fewer, you know, they had didn't have as many planes with Mint on it back in the day. And so they would do, you know, Barbados got a Saturday turn. And, you know, a couple other destinations, I think St. Martin may have gotten a Saturday turn. And now they're slowly growing that as well, where it makes sense. But, you know, growing in where they can take an aircraft that's otherwise idle versus committing to daily service from a 787 all the way to China, which is really expensive because it's really far away. I sort of get it. But at the same time, it does make me wonder a little bit about their route network and where the feed really is.
Well, but other than that, okay, so they're clearly not going after Chicago originating traffic because those routes are already served. So why connect them to Chicago to begin with? Why not connect people in Miami or Dallas where you have much more better flow already?
Yeah, Or Charlotte. Remember they own Charlotte too now.
Or Charlotte, where they're adding two new fights. I can't remember where what the destinations are, but they're adding two new routes out of Charlotte as well. So this all after they just put up a huge stink of wanting more gates at Chicago, but they're retreating in some ways.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not sure I'd call it a retreat, but I agree with you that they are having trouble finding the right mix in Chicago.
Over the course of a week, the number of seats they're flying out of Chicago goes down.
That's fair.
178 and all these 7-3s versus a daily 7-8, right?
Well, is seat miles goes down or seats?
Oh, seats. And probably seat miles, too.
Well, you're swapping 178 for another 7-8, right?
But that's a week. Or that's daily, but that's only for a portion of the...
it's only seasonal.
Yeah, it's only for 4 months, 5 months.
Gotcha. Yeah, so that's fair. Yeah, so are all the Caribbean flights are also only seasonal. So,
and they're only one day a week.
Yeah, so by the time we get to next summer, it may be way less. So, well, that's fair. What we don't know necessarily is what they'll do for domestic connections or domestic volume through there. I did find it interesting that one of the examples he gave in sort of coming up with the pricing for how, explaining the pricing of some of these tickets and why China, the Beijing route was so not profitable or unprofitable, is St. Louis to Beijing, the walk-up fare is like $250 one way. So plus, it ends up being just under $700 all in round trip. And you can, after I listened to that, because I'm surprised, you can buy that.
But Beijing fares are cheap all over.
Are typically low. Yeah. Yes. So that's not. But as a walk-up fare, it was a little surprising to me.
But it's not that surprising because there's so much extra capacity to China right now because of all the Chinese carriers. Most of the walk-up fares to China are cheap. The only exception is China.
I've seen a few. Yeah, and I've done it at Beijing to Boston. I've been tempted a couple times to do that one. It's like you can get it in advance one way down under around 300 a lot of the time. But even walk up, one way comes up towards 500, 600, but still not a bad value if you can find it to work. Yeah. But what was really surprising to me is he used that as an example and basically said, if we take people on St. Louis, Chicago, Beijing, instead of we lose the opportunity to put them on St. Louis, Chicago, London, and we lose the opportunity to put them on St. Louis, Chicago, anywhere else that's going to make more money. And I looked at the fares and the routes that were available, and American also sells that Beijing fare from St. Louis via DFW and via Los Angeles.
Okay.
And so part of me says, dude, you're in charge of network, and the guys who run scheduling and all that stuff work for you, tell them to not allow the St. Louis, Chicago, Beijing routing on that fare. And then you can try, that lets you protect that routing and try to find higher value customers to put across Chicago to get to Beijing. I'm not sure it works, but it was a weird one to me. I'm like, if you don't want to carry people from St. Louis through Chicago, don't. You can put that in the routing rules.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was weird to me. But what are you going to do? At least we know that cheap fares to and from Beijing aren't mistake fares, so Lufthansa can't sue us for talking about them.
That's good to know. That was a weird one.
One of our good friends shared that with me. It was because the ruling was in German, and obviously it took me a little while to sift through it. I kept reading it and kept going back to him we were texting back and forth. I'm like, is this for real? Did they really say this? Right. And so basically what it comes down to is it like Vacation Holiday Pirates or something like that is a website, in German-based website that focuses a lot on mistake fares and good deals and whatever. And so they're one of the many, many different companies that sort of does that. And Lufthansa sued them after the Germany to West Coast U.S. business class mistake fare was published last October, I think, is when it was for sale.
No.
And it was
like 600 in August, early September.
Okay. So 687 euros round trip instead of 3,500 euros round trip. And we all flew on it. So yay us. But that's how when we were all in Europe and Germany in January, back when we did our on location episode, that's how we all got home. So a little irony in that. But basically Lufthansa sued them saying that because they advertised it as an error fare and called extra attention to it, it was unfair competition because Lufthansa operates a website that sells plane tickets and markets them, and these guys operate a website that sells plane tickets and markets them.
Do they actually sell plane tickets?
I don't know, but either way, it's to me a completely ridiculous argument, but Lufthansa won. I don't get that, but Lufthansa won. And, it's one of those things, I guess the law doesn't necessarily make sense, but it's still the law. And here we are. So basically, if these guys publish Lufthansa fares and advertise them as aerofares, someone can go to jail for 6 months, or there's a €250,000 fine.
But I mean, and we've seen that, you know, even in the U.S., there were some recent ones, and I can't remember which ones, but the people were called them aerofares, and then the airline claimed that these people already knew they were errors. And it's minutia at this point.
It is to an extent. What's interesting to me is, you know, 3 years ago or 5 years ago when the DOT rules were super pro-consumer, it didn't matter if it was an aerofare. The guidance explicitly said even if it's an airline declares it a mistake, they still have to honor it.
Yep.
Right? And we said this at the time, and we can still say it today. It was a pendulum, and it swings back and forth, and it's gone sort of pretty far back the other direction. Now the airline can just say, oops, no, it was a mistake, and act with impunity, which maybe it should, maybe it shouldn't. The vast majority of the time when it does these sorts of things, it really was a mistake. What's really interesting to me, sort of as an aside, from the filing with Lufthansa is they admit that someone in their pricing department filled out a spreadsheet wrong and then uploaded that with the pricing, and that's why the fare was misfiled.
Well, that's what amazes me, is that they're using spreadsheets for this.
They all do.
I know, but it's still, like, preposterous to me that they use spreadsheets, and they haven't figured out how to use macros to catch errors like that.
Well, they can't catch the errors through a macro, through something else that checks if port gets uploaded. I feel like there's systems that actually offer that, you know, can do this for the airlines, but none of them use it. But then again, it turns out they don't have to because it doesn't cost them anything.
But that's,
they can keep winning these cases, except it does cost them stuff.
It does cost them. It costs them a lot of negative publicity because there's a lot of challenges around that, right?
Yeah.
And an example of this lawsuit makes the airline come out looking bad. Whether or not they're right still makes them look bad because they fought it.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the things Lufthansa mentions, is if they actually fight to enforce their right to not honor the tickets as a, you know, mutual error clause or whatever, they look like jackasses, and it costs them a lot of money because they have to do each one individually. And they said they spent €15,000 fighting one case in England, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it's amusing to me, but it was really funny to see them sort of mention some of the other mistake fares and what they were supposed to be and how many tickets were sold. So that Germany to West Coast thing, they only sold about 600 of them.
Okay.
And they discovered it, you know, it was middle of the night Germany time, and they got it closed off within 5 hours, and they were really proud of themselves for that.
I know back in the day, I remember that Continental acquired some software that was supposed to catch these. And basically, it's just when there's a drastic variance in the fare, it flags it, which is a pretty trivial thing to do. Yet, even then, they were misfiling fares. So presumably, they still use it since they kept shares. But how do you, like, if you have something like that in place, it just means your people aren't paying attention. So at what point does it become your responsibility as the airline when your people aren't paying attention?
I agree. And certainly, given that the airlines have, you know, my thing about it is if they're not going to honor it, they, you know, the same way that a customer gets 24 hours, maybe the airline should get 24 hours too, but after that they're stuck.
Right.
Right? Like, there's a lot of different ways you could go about this to make it a little more fair for everyone. On the other hand, like, I run my own business. I screw up from time to time. I do my best to make good on it, but I haven't had a situation where I've screwed up to the level that it would bankrupt me to, you know, honor what I did, but these aren't going to bankrupt the airline, but, you know, I certainly don't go back and be like, oops, my bad, you're screwed now, sorry, you don't get this thing that I promised you. We make something work, so it's...
But I presume you have errors and omission insurance or something like this, and even if you don't, these companies do.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, I don't, I should, but I'm not really good at running a business, so there you go. The whole lawsuit was interesting. What's also interesting about it is, at least initially, it seems to only apply to this one company and Lufthansa and not any other variations. So you can keep calling them mistake fares, just don't do it in Germany and don't do it if you're actually pushing to other people, you know, pushing them as a marketing thing to other people.
Well, actually, I think, quick candidly, I think people should just stop using the term mistake fare, because the moment any one person categorizes it as a mistake, the airline can then go use that as a defense. If you call it a promotional fare, because we've seen some really crazy valid promotional fares over the years, they can't stand, it's harder for them to say it was a mistake. But the moment someone in the community says it was a mistake, they will continue to just grab onto that and say, look, they knew it was a mistake. They knew it was a mistake.
Yeah. No, you're probably right. So if you're a thought leader, stop calling them errors. How's that?
Sorry.
Anywho, let's keep going around the world here and move over towards the Middle East. There's a few topics that are interesting there. First up, Emirates is actually going to have premium economy. Can you believe it?
I'm amazed.
It's going to be a couple of years till it's flying, but Sir Tim Clark, the president, did a podcast, an internal company podcast, and in talking, you know, in this discussion, mentioned that the next tranche of A380s that they take delivery of will have premium economy on board. And it was interesting to hear him say it is, we've designed the product, we know where on the airplane it's going to sit, we know all of these things, but we're also still working out the math to make sure it makes sense. So, I mean, it is happening, but it was interesting to hear him say, like, we got it ready, we're good, we're going to have it, it's going to be awesome. I mean, you know, once we finally figure it out.
Well, could this be that because not all their planes will be in the air so much, that they have the elasticity in the fleet to take them out of service and put these in?
That's an interesting comment. And so, I mean, the other challenge that the company is facing is they're calling it a natural shift due to, you know, seasonal variance in scheduling and demand. Other people are saying they've actually run out of pilots.
Well, so. they actually, and I don't remember where I read this, maybe it was Bloomberg or something, but they actually came out and said that they're seeing much increased competition with the Chinese carriers for pilots, because the Chinese carriers, as they're growing at an epic rate, they're throwing all sorts of benefits at pilots who are opting to go there.
Which is what Emirates did when it was growing for pilots relative to
exactly
Europe or the North American carriers. So turned about as fair play. But so they have finally come out and admitted it's a pilot issue also?
Yes.
Okay, because the initial response was, no, we just decided to cut all these flights and ground all these airplanes because, it was a good idea. Yeah. We meant to do that.
Yeah, no, there's something I read last week that said that they've admitted that they're having an increased challenge with pilots, and that's why some of the reductions like Fort Lauderdale and these others we're seeing just because they just don't have enough pilots to staff them.
Yeah, and obviously they're going to pick the underperforming routes, so like Fort Lauderdale, not surprisingly, will be one of the most affected or earlier affected routes, but yeah, so it would be nice if you had, you know, if they were optimizing everything and had the seats available and were ready to go to start installing the premium economy on these planes that are grounded while they're waiting or do whatever other maintenance needs to happen. It would be interesting to see if they do some of that stuff out of sequence or not. I don't think premium economy will happen early based on that, which good news, bad news. I sort of get it, but also I can see why they don't want to rush that into service and not necessarily, you know, they have like 100 A380s, right? I mean, it's a lot of planes to need to fit, and you need the seats, and you need to have it all ready to go, and you need to have figured out how you're going to do the sales of it on different routes. That's the thing that I think they're going to struggle the most with, is they don't have, you know, aircraft necessarily dedicated to specific routes and dedicated to subfleets. They have a couple, like their 772 LR fleet is small enough that they can sort of call it a dedicated fleet to a couple routes, but everything else is like, you know, there's the two cabin A380s and the three cabins. And the two cabin is a relatively small population, but it's growing. I think it's the ideal candidate for premium economy.
Well, I think one of their challenges is going to be, it might be smart that they're holding off on marketing it simply because there is a glut. There's going to be a very big glut of premium economy in the next 2 years because everyone's rushing to do it.
Finally.
Yeah, everyone's doing it at once. And there's going to be such a glut that you're going to be competing with all these other people. Whereas if you really take your time and let it iron out and see what the real markets are, because not every market's going to support premium economy.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And one of the interesting things to me about it is, I mean, you say everybody's finally doing it. We're looking at some airlines that are running second generation stuff fine.
Right.
I mean, it's not new, but for the U.S. carriers are finally deciding to do it. So that's significant. It's going to be a couple year rollout for them. American will be first and fast. They'll be done next year. United will be 2020, 2021, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Delta, I don't know, but they're not going spectacularly quickly. And so in that sense, you know, everybody's finally doing it. But in Europe, it's been around for a while.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, you're seeing BA has some aircraft with the older version, some with the newer. Air France desperately needs a newer version. Their old version is old. If they're still in business.
Yeah, because there was just an article that I posted. BBC is now saying Air France might not survive this latest round of strikes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the CEO resigned.
Yep.
We didn't have this on our topic list, but I'll put it in there. The CEO resigned because the pilots are the cabin crew are demanding a 5% raise this year. The company offered 7% over 4 years and they rejected it. And he said, okay, well, I no longer can work. I tried my best. Someone else come do it.
Yeah. I call on everyone to be responsible. Crew, ground staff, and pilots were asking for unjustified pay hikes. The survival of Air France is in the balance. He said, adding that the state would not serve as a backdrop for the airline's debts.
So that's transportation minister.
Yep.
That wasn't the CEO.
Right.
But yeah, that was a pretty crazy statement also.
Yeah.
That's the French government owns like 15% of the company. And so some people are assuming they would foot the bill for whatever has to happen. But he's basically said, no, if you guys can't figure it out, we'll let that money fall.
Yeah, the final quote is, Air France will disappear if it does not make the necessary efforts to be competitive.
Yeah, so I applaud them for, you know, towing the line right now. We'll see, obviously, what actually happens. But it's interesting. But anyway, back to Emirates.
You know, Emirates might be able to get Air France pilots now.
Well, there you go. Solve that problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody wins.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting to me about putting premium economy on the 380s. I wonder if they do it only on the two cabin ones and put them in that front section where first class was. Because otherwise you have to put it, like, if you need, the weird thing about the layout on the Emirates 380s is the bar goes all the way to the back. So business class runs all the way to the rear of the aircraft. So if you want to put it upstairs, you can't put it at the back, which is typically where it has gone for airlines that put it upstairs. And then if you put it downstairs, you're eroding your regular economy product as opposed to necessarily your premium products. And so, you know, maybe that's a good sign for passengers that they think they've got enough premium demand that they can, you know, take some, you know, the first few rows of regular economy out from downstairs at the front of the cabin and make that premium. But I don't know. It's the one thing I haven't quite figured out where they're going to put it.
And they might not have figured that out themselves yet.
No, Clark's comment is, we know where we're going to put it. We figure out which zone it's going to be.
Oh, so okay.
It'll be interesting. I can't wait to see that. Just across the way in the Middle East, Qatar Airways is feeling quite generous these days and is offering to loan some airplanes to their colleagues at British Airways.
Now, will they put them?
The 787s are having the Rolls-Royce engine issues.
And that problem continues to get worse. But so one of the questions that that brings up is, will they put a little clause in that they can't fly to the U.S. just to piss AA off? that they have to fly across the U.S.?
I say they have to,
yeah. One way or the other?
It's what's really interesting to me is I assume they would be Qatar aircraft operated by BA crew. I would assume they're dry lease, not wet lease, right? Mm-hmm. Because otherwise the BA unions would almost certainly freak out. It's better to lease those planes as replacements than high fly or something like that. Also, high fly is going to run out of planes eventually, given that everybody else wants them for these operations. Norwegian, I don't know if you saw, has leased a 777 for its Newark routes. So to Paris. So that's how they're dealing with it, or one of the ways they're dealing with it. And Virgin pulled its 346 that it retired. They retired a plane back in March. They're pulling it back out of Tupelo. It was set to be made into soda cans, and they're pulling it out.
I think the Norwegian one might be more than one, because I thought it was two routes that they were doing now.
Yeah, they have a couple of them figured out. And then, so it's you know, it's what's funny to me there, again, though, you've got Qatar Airways saying, oh, yeah, you know, BA needs these, we can do that. And at the same time, Qatar Airways is borrowing A350s from LATAM, because LATAM didn't have demand, and they're an investor there. And now they're, like, pulling these planes in, but pushing some planes out, because they're also an investor in IAG. And also, oh, by the way, they sort of are supposed to be running their own airline.
Well, the problem they're having right now is demand is a little low because of the embargo.
Right, the Saudi blockade is still screwing them
and
over.
And so, it's, in some ways, it's smart that they can do this because it reduces some of their demand, their inventory, but it also gives them revenue for those planes rather than just sitting there.
Sure, and I mean, that's why they were, when the BA mixed fleet cabin crew was on strike, they were able to send 320s up.
Yep.
For the same reason, they had them all sitting there because these are the planes that would typically have been flying into Saudi. So,
yeah,
it's interesting to me just to see how this sort of shell game is moving around and ultimately how it plays out into sort of future aircraft demand. And then you've got Etihad, speaking of future aircraft demand, with something like 150-ish twin aisle planes on order from both Boeing and Airbus. And these were deals signed at the beginning of the decade when they had the massive expansion going on and had investments in all these successful airlines like Alitalia and Air Berlin. Side note, were never really successful. And they wanted to have all these aircraft, and they figured, okay, well, we'll take them in-house, and if we don't need them in Abu Dhabi, we can push them to one of our other investment airlines. And they're running out of places. They're running out of money, and B, they're running out of places to put these new aircraft. And now the news this weekend has been that there's discussions about they may need to restructure, defer, delay, completely screw over these orders. And what are Boeing and Airbus going to do?
You know, I think Etihad should take this by two different prongs. A, become an airline leasing company, and then B, go buy Rolls-Royce.
Oh, man. God. You're really trying to tweet. Oh, man. Boss.
Too far?
I don't even know. No, it's not too far. It's just going to take me a minute to recover.
Okay.
you know, I only laugh a little bit because Norwegian does own a leasing company.
Hey!
And is trying to figure out what it's going to do with some of its pending aircraft orders that may are more likely now to be transferred to the leasing company rather than operated in-house.
As IAG tries to acquire them.
Right. So, have we talked about that yet?
I think we briefly talked about it, but this week they confirmed that they've gotten two bids from IAG that they've said no to both of those.
Yeah. All right. We should put that on a schedule on the agenda for next week or the week after for a more in-depth conversation, because I think that's crazy stuff. And mostly good crazy, but it's interesting. Anyway, yeah, the Etihad situation is weird. Not weird, it's challenging, and it's going to be really, really interesting to see what both Airbus and Boeing do about it. I think Boeing has sort of a good opportunity in that some of the 787s could end up at American for that new order. Some of those, you know, delivery slots can be shifted around. But, you know, Airbus, the 330 program was already suffering pretty badly, and especially 330neo, and, like, I don't remember if the Etihad orders were 350s or 330s, but...
Well, if Etihad was smart and bought Rolls-Royce engines, they won't have to pay for those.
Oh, yeah, because they couldn't deliver them anyway.
Exactly.
Because they don't fly.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Continuing our travels east. Hawaii.
Hawaii.
We went really far east, all the way so far that we're back to west again.
We've gone plaid.
That reminds me. I actually wanted to talk about Plum, not plaid, but we'll get to that in a minute. Southwest has announced now both the mainland and the Hawaiian Islands gateway airports that it's going to use, and also its intention to operate inter-island flights in Hawaii.
So before you start talking about the inter-island stuff,
yes.
We haven't talked about the second incident with Southwest.
The second incident?
The one with the cracked window last week.
Oh, yeah!
We totally missed that one.
Eh, whatever.
Details.
Honestly, what's interesting to me about that is a couple people, you know, relatively very smart, knowledgeable people in the industry have said, windows don't break. Which is true, they don't. Like, they're, and it's okay, they're, you know, multiple players and whatever, and there wasn't decompression, so it's not necessarily risky. But it's interesting to me people saying, like, we're not really sure why this would happen, because windows generally don't break.
Well, once the window breaks, the decompression is likely inevitable.
Well, you gotta get through the multiple layers, though.
Right, but it'll happen, because you reduce the strength of the window. So it's just an amount of time before it actually happens.
Sure, I mean, I'm not suggesting, like, they fly around finish a transcon with a broken window like that, but it's not nearly as urgent a situation as an actual, you know, as a puncture where there was real decompression. Okay.
Absolutely, but it raises a good question of this shouldn't happen.
Right. The only thing I can think of is somehow the window got scuffed or scratched. Right. My take on that is, like, you need a weak spot, and then, you know, if you can scratch something or attack something with a point as opposed to a flat hand, you're much more likely to cause pain or, you know, to break it, and so. Something like that must have happened, but I don't know. It's weird. I'm sure someone will investigate it and let us know eventually.
Sure we will.
All right. Back to Hawaii. Southwest announced the four big airports in Hawaii are going to be its destinations on that end. On the mainland side, it's Oakland, Sacramento, San Jose, and San Diego, all four California airports. All four are California airports, I should say, are going to be the gateways there. And that makes sense to me for the most part. A lot of people were surprised no Los Angeles, no LAX, and even nothing in the basin.
There's so much lift out of LAX, though.
There's so much lift, and it's gate-restricted, it's slot-limited. Like, getting more capacity in there is really hard versus providing the sort of shorter, high-yielding north-south business traveler services that Southwest runs. I can understand why they don't want to erode that market. So, yeah. And again, these are just the airports where it's starting. They can always add more later as they establish things and figure it out. So, but the inter-island, I think, is really interesting. And this part of this goes back to the engine questions. Part of it goes back to how aggressive is Hawaiian going to defend itself. And part of it goes to how is Southwest going to staff it.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, the crew rest rules, essentially, flight attendants and pilots coming in from the mainland can do one or maybe two very short flights on that same duty day, but really not a ton of service.
Right.
Or they overnight and then work, you know, this is how a lot of the international tag flights work, is the crew overnight. So you'd fly, say, Sacramento, Honolulu. That would be your duty day. It's a short day. Or maybe you come from somewhere else into Sacramento and then onward. And then that's your sort of 8-hour duty day. And then you fly 2 round trips, 3 round trips within the islands is another 8-hour trip, another 8-hour day. and then you fly home back to the mainland, right? That's sort of those extra days worked in there, and that becomes a 3-day or a 4-day trip. There's sort of doing that versus flying in, doing the one tag flight, and then flying back. The problem if you only do the tag flights is that they're timed for when the flights to and from the mainland happen, and so it's basically all midday, mid-morning to mid-afternoon. There's not, you don't have the evening flights, you don't have the morning flights that business travelers want. You know, someone who wants to do a day trip from Maui to Honolulu can't use 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. flights. They need 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. So obviously until we know what they're really planning to do, it's hard to judge how effective we think it'll be. But I can get that a lot of people want Southwest service for free checked bags. Side note, not free, just included. Compare your fares. But there are some reasons that would go well. But when they were talking about it, the guy, he was the president who was out in Hawaii doing the interviews, said they were planning on hiring local for ground services, but didn't say anything about pilots and cabin crew.
Right.
And crew in Hawaii is expensive. Like, labor in Hawaii is not cheap. Nothing in Hawaii is cheap. But
no, and to survive inter-island successfully, you need a lot of frequency.
Yeah, I mean, Hawaiian does a lot of flights, and they do them on the 717s, which are better at handling the short hops, you know, short cycle times, but still not great at it.
No, I read somewhere that Hawaiian's maintenance costs is 2.5 times more than Delta for their 717 fleet.
Yep, and that's data comes from the DOT. They file that. It's amazing what data the airlines all file at the DOT. It was another friend of ours actually posted it on Twitter, and I included it in my story. And you may have seen it elsewhere also. But yeah, it's nuts. So, I mean, that's a ton of frequencies. And so how do you compete against that and still make these planes affordable to operate? And I just don't know.
Well, the other question I have is, what are they going to do for maintenance?
Yes.
With these planes will take a lot of wear and tear doing these short hops.
So yeah, going back to the engine cycles discussion we had last week and the week before is, and we can sort of segue into that a little bit later, but this is, it's bad for engine cycles, right? This consumes, it's a lot of, it adds cycles and adds stress to the fan blades, to all the life-limited parts. It drives up the maintenance costs. And do you necessarily have to do maintenance while on island? I guess because Southwest is cycling the planes in and out, it can sort of distribute that across a broader subsection of the fleet.
But they're going to have problems. Like, you're going to have inevitable problems.
Yeah.
And Hawaiian doesn't have 737s, so they won't have parts for 737s. United does.
Sure. And, the airlines are all pretty good about setting up those relationships and having the option to buy parts from each other and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, in that sense, it works. But, so, you know, they're going to have the right people and whatever and inventory to do some of the maintenance. I mean, are you going to end up like that Emirates 777 that was stuck in Seattle where Delta's like, oh, yeah, we have that part. Oh, never mind. We won't give it to you. Last year that happened, right?
But even United, right? They probably have some 737 parts, but not for the amount of frequencies that Southwest is planning to dump on the market.
Sure. And if they run that contract correctly, I mean, I'm sure United would be happy to stock extra parts with their maintenance staff if Southwest needs them, but Southwest is going to have to pay for that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of questions about inter-island service, and I understand why they want to do it. It is, for the distances and the times, you know, the amount of time that the planes spend in the air, it's decent revenue. And we have to remember that the guy who's in charge of finance, I think, for Southwest used to work at Hawaiian. So he knows the numbers. He knows the market. Andrew Waterman, he knows the market. So they do know what they're doing, but it still makes me wonder what the hell are they doing.
Well, and I'm sure that Hawaiian will vehemently defend their footprint because they have historically.
Yeah. They have gone to war, fair war-wise, against GO, which was the Mesa operation. They are pretty aggressive with Island. Is it Island Air? Mokulele is the one that's still flying on
Cessnas.
I think
so, yeah.
Right? I mean, when they fly six Cessnas and Hawaiian has 20 717s, the capacity isn't enough to really impact things. But Hawaiian is still pretty aggressive at pushing them around. And, you know, I know the fight with GO is part of what put Aloha out of business, because Aloha also had to respond to those crazy low fares. But Hawaiian was willing to, has pretty deep pockets and was willing to do that. Now, Southwest has really deep pockets,
and arguably. And Hawaiians are kind of loyal to their local establishments.
That's the other thing, is that the Hawaii residents are typically, have been loyal to Hawaiian Airlines. And, I remember when I was out there many years ago when Go was around, the campaigns sort of against Go for how it was ruining Hawaiian Airlines and how they destroyed Aloha was serious brand problems for the company.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. You reminded me about the We've Gone Plaid thing really reminded me. Delta's going plum.
Okay.
Have you seen the new Delta uniforms?
No.
They have purple in them.
Are they rebranding themselves?
No, they're just going plum. They come out in a couple of weeks. It's crazy. I don't understand
it
at all.
Did they get a nice discount from Twin Hill?
Ooh. Have to check with American and see how those deals are going.
Sorry, too easy.
Yeah, but so you haven't seen it. This is disappointing to me. I wanted to talk about that. I should have mentioned it earlier. Yeah, they have purple in their uniforms now, and I think it's a hard color to pull off in general. And the fact that they're trying to blend it with the red and the blue of Delta,
Oh my God, this is what happens to an airline when Barney takes over.
There you go. So now you've seen it.
Yes. Why? What? Why?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, okay, well, you had red and you had blue. I don't know. Let's just mix them together and see what happens.
To be frank, I'm not a big fan of Delta, but the red was a beautiful color and it stood out, caught a lot of attention, and they got a lot of press from it. But why would you, why break something that isn't broken? Why fix something that ain't broken?
Yeah. The purple, man. I just don't know. I just don't know. We should maybe get John Walton as a guest back on here and ask him what he thinks. He's a big purple fan.
I like the color purple, but this is just like Barney.
Yeah. I don't get it as a... I could buy it as an accent color?
No, I can tell you exactly why. Virgin.
Yeah?
Yeah, I bet you it has to do with a closer alignment with Virgin.
Virgin uses purple?
I do believe they use purple in a bunch of stuff.
I know Virgin America did for, the cabin lighting and stuff, but...
Want to say I've seen purple in the Virgin Atlantic. Yeah, the Virgin Atlantic is in purple. The words in the logo.
Yeah, well, that still seems like a stupid reason to do it to me.
I agree.
Anyway, last topic. Pet Pass?
It's coming back, but with restrictions.
Yay?
I guess. I guess Rolo can fly again, depending on what breed he is.
So the story here is that after that dog in the overhead died a couple months, was it a month ago, maybe?
It was longer. I think it was in late February, early March that happened.
Okay. But all this stuff blends together in my brain, unfortunately. United, in addition to saying it changed a whole lot of the pet rules and said they actually fully stopped pets in cargo while they were trying to figure out what was going on. And now that they're bringing it back, they're very significantly limiting what types of animals will be carried. And United was historically way more lenient in terms of what they were willing to accept both on board and in the cargo hold. And now they're pretty much matching everybody else in terms of limiting what breeds they will take. And part of that is some breeds are more susceptible to stress and dying on airplanes or in travel in general. And part of it, I think that's the big part of it. And then just generally sort of limiting their exposure and liability.
So, one of the interesting things that I read after the whole pet pass embargo is there's a story of a deployed person in the U.S. military who was on their... Do you remember this?
Well, I know that it was an issue in terms of they were a bunch of people out in Guam that wanted to come home and had pets and all of a sudden couldn't do it anymore.
Right, because in this case, the dog was too big for the military transport. So the woman's only option was pet pass, but pet pass went to suspension at the time.
Yeah.
And so she had no idea how to get the dog home because nobody else would carry it. So while there was a lot of negative press around pet pass, it was interesting that it actually does bring some unique advantages to people that you wouldn't otherwise normally have.
And eventually United relented specifically for military.
Yeah.
To get basically out of Guam to solve this problem. But yes, I do remember that was that happened. So it's good stuff, I guess. I don't know.
Leave Rover at home if you're not moving. That's my guidance.
Yeah. I tend to feel that way too, but like I said, I don't have a dog, so it's I guess not my position to say so. I don't know.
I don't have a dog either, but it causes extra stress. It's not like dogs are excited about flying like we are.
Yeah. Well, no one's excited about flying like we are, let's be clear.
Well, so we have a disease that hasn't spread to dogs yet.
Exactly. Thank goodness. Anyways, yeah, it is nice that they're bringing it back. It'll be interesting to see if, some of the stats around it change significantly given the new restrictions and all those things, or if it continues to be a challenge for the company.
I mean, it was interesting. The statistics are all skewed, right? Like, everyone is saying United kills more pets. It also carries a lot more pets.
Right.
Like, it's a numbers game. It's going to happen.
Absolutely. No, I'm completely with you on that. But that's what I'm saying. I wonder if we'll see a percentage numbers change. I know that – I actually haven't checked the – and I don't know if the Senate has come close to putting its FAA reauth bill through. That when the House version of it did not include new pet rules that I'm aware of. And there had been some discussion about that. I know one of the things the DOT had wanted airlines to start reporting on was more specifics around pets carried and pet deaths. But I don't know if that's actually going to happen or not based on airlines don't want to do it and the government being somewhat willing to not require new reporting from airlines these days.
Well, there's so much data out there already, as you already pointed out.
Yeah, but we don't necessarily – we know the deaths. Generally, we don't necessarily know the number carried.
Right.
That's why it's a little harder. But anyway. Alrighty. I think we're going to call that an episode. And hope I can squeeze the two halves together. Listeners, did you notice that I hung up on Foz accidentally halfway through the show? Tell me where.
I'll add one thing. Before we end, I briefly talked to Tom as a follow up from last week's podcast.
Oh yeah.
And this past week, the FAA issued a new AD, which he said he felt much better about because it addresses some of his explicit concerns. So we'll try to get him back on the show. He couldn't do it today.
Yeah, I think the short version of that is more engines will be inspected and more blades will be inspected more often.
Yeah.
So. Good news for passengers, bad news for airlines and costs. I don't know if CFM is going to eat that cost or if the airlines are going to have to suck it up, but probably good news for mechanics, I guess. They get more work. Yay.
Yeah, more overtime.
So, alrighty. On that note, thanks for listening. You can find us on Twitter at DotsLines. You can find us on the web, moredotsmorelines.com. Hit us up on Patreon if you want to listen to the episodes early, and we've actually been pretty successful about making that happen, getting them out a few days ahead of time these days. So that's exciting. And other than that, go fly somewhere. It's good for you. Take care.
Go us. Take care. Bye-bye.